Joe Rochefort's War, the Odyssey of the Codebreaker Who Outwitted Yamamoto at Midway, by Elliot Carlson, narrated by Danny Campbell. Copyright 2011 by Elliot Carlson. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Naval Institute Press and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. To Commander Joe Rochefort must forever go the acclaim for having made more difference at a more important time than any other naval officer in history. Captain Edward L. Beach, U.S. Navy, retired. The United States Navy, 200 years. Foreword. This book is an account that is long overdue. Joseph J. Rochefort was a singular player on the world scene in the early months of the Second World War, but his major accomplishments at that time became buried in a cloak of security and unjustified criticism. Chief among his achievements was the crucial role he played in the stunning American victory in the Battle of Midway, although his contribution would remain unappreciated for decades, even after his death. As a Naval Reserve ensign, I was an analyst assigned to Rochefort's Combat Intelligence Unit, CIU, at Pearl Harbor in February 1942, and I can attest to the validity of both his stellar successes then, as well as his occasional questionable actions. Joe Rochefort was a complicated naval officer in a manner that can be properly understood only by looking at his entire life, now revealed for the first time in this book. From humble beginnings, he was attracted to the Navy in the immediate aftermath of World War I. He enlisted at the age of 17, thanks to a little imagination regarding his date of birth. His enlisted service demonstrated that he possessed latent intellect and capabilities that ultimately led to an officer's commission without the benefit of having graduated from the Naval Academy. As the reader will see, some of that background served to haunt him for much of his career, despite his brilliant service to the Navy and the nation. The highlight of Rochefort's career was his amazing thoroughness in identifying, interpreting, and reporting to Admiral Chester W. Nimitz the Japanese plans to assault and capture Midway Atoll. The enemy saw Midway as the first step in defeating the U.S. fleet and eventually removing the threat of the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. That Rochefort provided such critical intelligence accurately and in time for Admiral Nimitz to organize and deploy a credible defense made the difference between our forces participating in the Battle of Midway and not even knowing that the Japanese were headed there. Clearly, Rochefort's work enabled the victory at Midway, but his contribution to the battle, as well as the impact on history of the battle itself, are still being debated today. Rochefort's detractors outnumbered his supporters, and they held higher positions in the Navy's hierarchy, resulting in occasionally unjust treatment as the years and his career progressed. But he never displayed any sense of defeat or disappointment over the consequences of such treatment. His first loyalty was to the Navy, and he accepted his fate as it arose, continuing to carry out his duties with enthusiasm and distinction wherever he was assigned. In all respects, he was a leader who was held in high regard by his subordinates. I'm honored to have been included among them. My experiences during that early and critical period of the war are clearly the most memorable of my 42 years of service to the intelligence arms of the Navy and the federal government. Although my personal contact with Commander Rochefort was limited at the time, I had an opportunity to observe him on a daily basis. Plus, I was able to learn more about him from his friend and former Fleet Intelligence Officer Edwin Layton. I still regard Rochefort, Layton, and Jasper Holmes, one of Rochefort's top analysts at the CIU, as my primary mentors and the ones who most influenced my decision for a career in naval intelligence. As you will hear toward the end of this book, a great American president cited Rochefort for inclusion among a few who individually made a difference in the outcome of a history-changing battle. That puts him in lofty company, with men like Themistocles at Salamis, Admiral de Grasse in the Chesapeake Bay, and Colonel Joshua Chamberlain at Little Round Top. But Rochefort stands out even among that noble company, for he achieved his triumph without ever firing a shot, or even coming within sight of the enemy. With the long-suppressed facts of his life masterfully revealed on these pages by Elliot Carlson, the full and factual story of Joseph Rochefort can now be known. Rear Admiral Donald Mack Showers, U.S. Navy, retired. Introduction. The Riddle of Joe Rochefort. Rochefort is caustic, witty, unorthodox, tactless, intolerant, blunt but quick, intimate, and brilliant. Walter Lord. In spring 1942, Commander Joe Rochefort, America's lead cryptanalyst at Pearl Harbor, appeared to be one of the rising stars in the U.S. Navy. Just about everybody who knew this bright, sharp-edged, competent officer believed he was headed for the highest rungs on the Navy ladder, almost certainly flag rank. It was just a matter of time. Rochefort himself had every reason to feel confident about the direction of his Navy career. He had just earned the gratitude of Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Pacific Fleet, for his role in the Battle of Midway, which lasted June 4th through 7th. Rochefort headed the unusual group of codebreakers that had cracked the Imperial Japanese Navy's operational code just prior to the battle. That coup fixed the two small islands of the Midway Atoll as the probable target of Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto's impending campaign in the Central Pacific. Not all Navy leaders accepted Rochefort's forecast. Many in Washington, along with some of the U.S. Army's top brass, flatly rejected it, doubting Yamamoto would amass so large a force to seize a mere atoll of dubious strategic value. But Nimitz went along with Rochefort. He put his carriers in a place where they could surprise the sizable Japanese armada bearing down on Midway. They did so and achieved a stunning naval victory, an outcome that, some writers maintained, turned the tide of war against Japan in the Pacific. Nimitz credited Rochefort in part for that success and recommended him for a Distinguished Service Medal, DSM. But in the summer and fall of 1942, something happened to Rochefort's career. Late in June, for reasons that didn't seem clear, Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Fleet, denied Rochefort the DSM. 4 months later, in October, King approved a plan shaped by Rochefort's Washington bosses, Rear Admiral Joseph Redmond and his brother, Captain John Redmond, to oust Rochefort from his job running the Navy's code-breaking unit at Pearl. Suddenly, Rochefort was gone. Many people wondered what had happened to him. Members of his decrypt team were especially puzzled. They couldn't square the news of his expulsion with the Joe Rochefort they had served for 17 months in a dank basement at Pearl, the top-secret hideaway where they carried out their code-breaking effort. In that stuffy and frequently chilly haunt, they had come to know Rochefort as an exceptional individual, a tall, slender, taciturn officer who spoke quietly but knowingly, radiating authority and his own distinct brand of bemused seriousness. People liked being around him to soak up his smarts. True, he had his peculiarities, chief among them a capacity for irreverence, sarcasm, and blunt speech that astonished even his closest friends. Still, given his quick mind, obvious leadership abilities, and masterful performance during the weeks leading up to Midway, they regarded him as an officer on the way up, certainly not a candidate for misfortune. There did not seem to be an explanation for what had happened. From what Rochefort's friends believed, and even Rochefort himself, Admiral King had been influenced by officers around him who were part of an anti-Rochefort cabal, led by the Redmond brothers. They had clashed with Rochefort over Japan's target before the Battle of Midway, and were said to be motivated by jealousy and revenge when Rochefort's prediction held up. Adding another layer of interest to the drama was Rochefort's status as a Mustang, Navy slang for an officer who rose up the Navy ladder from enlisted ranks, not the Naval Academy. He wasn't part of the Annapolis Club. He didn't have friends in high places. Rochefort's downfall had all the makings of a great saga. After the war, bits and pieces of the story started to make their way into print, albeit slowly. In one of the first detailed accounts of the Battle of Midway, appearing in the 26th of March 1949 issue of the Saturday Evening Post, writer J. Bryan III called attention to the cryptanalytic prowess of a smart young officer, Commander Joseph J. Rochefort, who confirmed Midway as Yamamoto's target. Never a battle like Midway. More narratives were on the way. A milestone in the story occurred in 1967, when Walter Lord published his lively, groundbreaking book on Midway, Incredible Victory. Lord captured Rochefort breaking codes in his Pearl Harbor basement work area, a shambles of a place cluttered by stacks of folders and papers. Presiding over it all was a tall, thin, humorously caustic man in a red smoking jacket and carpet slippers, Commander Joseph J. Rochefort, Jr. Lord's version served as a kind of template for future Rochefort accounts. The saga evolved into a morality tale, complete with good guys and bad guys, the bad being the people who engineered the commander's sudden banishment from Pearl Harbor. In his 1985 Pacific War memoir, And I Was There, written by Rochefort's friend, Rear Admiral Edwin T. Layton, with help from co-authors John Costello and Captain Roger Pinot, U.S. Naval Reserve, retired, Rochefort is depicted as a gifted codebreaker martyred on the anvil of World War II Navy politics. Rochefort now became a legend, very nearly a figure of myth. As his story continued to unfold and accounts multiplied, Rochefort was invariably brilliant, if not actually a genius. He was the dean of the Navy's cryptanalysts, blessed with a superlative memory for detail and a deep intuitive knowledge built up over years of studying Japanese naval operations. Not only that, his colleagues considered him the finest cryptanalyst in the entire Navy. Yes, he had blemishes, but they were really functions of his virtues. They were what you would expect of an eccentric genius. He was quirky, touchy, a difficult customer, said one writer. He could be arrogant and irascible, added another. And he was also an idiosyncratic but scintillating cryptanalyst. To be sure, he had a weakness for caustic speech. After all, he was somewhat of a maverick. Separating myth from reality has never been easy with Rochefort. Too many people liked the legend. And Rochefort, for his part, complicated the search for reality by his own contrariness. He could be many things at once. Were they all real? Was he, for example, the dean of Navy cryptanalysts? Rochefort certainly learned and practiced cryptanalysis in Washington from 1925 to 1927. But for the next 14 years, from 1927 to 1941, he stayed as far away from cryptanalysis as he could get. He didn't look at another Japanese code until 1941, when, with war rapidly approaching, he agreed to head the Navy's codebreaking unit at Pearl Harbor. He hardly qualified as the dean of Navy cryptanalysts. Was he a maverick, an independent officer who didn't go along with the group? Rochefort did indeed display intellectual independence. He was inclined to speak his mind even when it would have been to his advantage to shut up. But if a maverick is someone inclined to go his own way at whatever cost, the vast majority of captains and admirals under whom he served didn't think so. Fitness reports described him repeatedly as an officer of excellent personal and military character. And when, after the war, he was asked why he hadn't written a book about his travails with his Washington bosses, the people who had derailed his career, Rochefort didn't hold back. I did not see that this would be to the advantage of the Navy. He may not have been an Annapolis man, but he was a Navy man, some maverick. The fantasizing got out of hand in 1976 when the actor Hal Holbrook, in the blockbuster movie Midway, portrayed Rochefort as a sort of clown, an officer who ambled about sloppily dressed in a red smock, spoke with a folksy twang, and when he wasn't puffing on a cigar and making wisecracks, rode around in a jeep with Admiral Nimitz. What Rochefort thought of Holbrook's portrayal would never be known. He didn't live long enough to say. Having served as a consultant on the movie, Rochefort died July 20, 1976, in Torrance, California, shortly after Midway was released. His friends, however, were outraged. Yes, Rochefort wore a burgundy corduroy smoking jacket in his work area, but he did so for good reasons, a cold, clammy basement habitat. "Everyone who spent hours on end in that environment had to add clothing for comfort," declared Rear Admiral Donald Mack Showers, U.S. Navy, retired, who served in Rochefort's unit in 1942. Holbrook's characterization could not have been more completely opposite Rochefort's true personality. The mustachioed, cigar-smoking, loudmouth, redneck type portrayed by Hal Holbrook was totally out of character. Joe Rochefort was clean-shaven, occasionally smoked a pipe at his desk, was quiet-mannered and soft-spoken, a gentleman in all respects. Given the mythology surrounding his career, it would be easy to lose sight of the fact that Rochefort was a real officer who did real things at Pearl Harbor. True, he didn't do everything by himself, or everything people said he did. The intelligence developed at Pearl Harbor was the work of many, not just Rochefort. And he didn't operate strictly as a cryptanalyst or codebreaker, as portrayed in most accounts. Others did that work. All that being said, it would be hard, if not impossible, to envision the Battle of Midway unfolding as it did without the involvement of Joe Rochefort. He was easily the most consequential shore-based actor in the Midway drama. As the head of Pearl's decrypt unit, he used his knowledge of the Japanese language and the tools of cryptology and radio intelligence to establish first, through consensus with his analysts, the target of the Japanese attack. Then he used the moral authority of his position to make that estimate stick with the officer who mattered most, Admiral Nimitz. And when doubters in both the Army and Navy challenged his Midway theory, Rochefort again, with help from his team, contrived what still stands as one of the supreme intelligence moments of World War II, an ingenious radio gimmick that tricked the Japanese into betraying Midway as the object of their impending campaign. Historian David M. Kennedy called this stroke the single most valuable intelligence contribution of the entire Pacific War. Remarkable as his work might have seemed, it wasn't enough. Not only did Admiral King veto his medal, but he stymied his subsequent naval career as well. Questions arise. What was going on in Washington to bring about such decisions? Was Rochefort, in truth, a victim of scheming by the Redmond brothers? Were they really all that jealous? Or did Rochefort exacerbate an already delicate situation? Did he use the word clowns once too often in dealing with his Washington adversaries? Was he an accomplice in his own downfall? Rochefort was indeed a difficult customer, as one writer aptly described him. An exploration of his life and naval career reveals an officer as puzzling as the codes he tried to break. Intentionally or not, he didn't make the researcher's job easy. He left few footprints as he moved through life. Always the intelligence officer, he continued to cover his tracks in retirement. Late in life, he destroyed his family letters, eliminating any record of his wartime correspondence with his wife, Faye, and other family members. much to the unhappiness of post-war writers who wanted to tap into his knowledge of Pearl Harbor and Midway, he did the same thing to nearly all of his Navy papers. The great tragedy is that in a fit of something or other, he destroyed all his papers some time back. The revisionist historian Harry Elmer Barnes wrote a colleague in 1962. Rochefort left only a small box containing little more than his Navy personnel records and a few Navy memoranda of special interest to him. As a result, a certain amount of mystery has always surrounded the life and career of Joe Rochefort. Many questions persist about things that happened and things that Rochefort did or failed to do. With the help of Rochefort's few papers, the records of many archives and libraries, and interviews with historians, family members, and some Navy colleagues who survived him, I have done my best to solve as much of the Rochefort puzzle as possible. The questions with which I was obsessed are by now probably those engrossing the reader. What led Rochefort to the Navy? Did his Mustang status hurt his career? What attracted him to, then turned him away from, cryptanalysis? At Pearl Harbor, could Rochefort have done more to warn Kimmel? What part did he play in breaking the Japanese naval code and in identifying Midway as Japan's target in spring 1942? And of course, the granddaddy of all questions. Did Rochefort deserve the DSM that he did not receive in 1942, but was awarded posthumously in 1986? Was Nimitz right about Rochefort, or was King? Did Rochefort's brusque, gloves-off style estrange his superiors in Washington? Just who was Joe Rochefort? 1. Trolley to San Pedro. I wanted to be an aviator, a naval aviator. I had a very high regard for these people. Joe Rochefort. Joseph John Rochefort entered the world on the 12th of May, 1900, the youngest of seven children born to Irish parents, Francis John and Ellen Rochefort of Dayton, Ohio. Francis, known as Frank, and Ellen were not stay-at-homes. 9 years earlier, they had moved their growing family from London, Ontario, 300 miles across the border in Canada, where sometime in the early 1880s, the two had met. Born in Dublin on the 2nd of February, 1852, Frank was something of a wanderer. Why he decided to leave Ireland wasn't recorded in any family history, but life was hard for many there, and may have been so for Frank, the son of a Catholic pawnbroker. Sizable numbers emigrated to either the United States or Canada. On the 16th of July, 1875, at age 23, Frank boarded a steamer that took him to Halifax, Nova Scotia, a major port of entry for Irish immigrants. From there, Frank made his way to London, a bustling city of about 30,000 that, while predominantly Protestant, had a sizable Irish Catholic community. He started at the bottom of the economic ladder, working first as a miller at a grain mill, then tending bar in a hotel in downtown London. There he met an attractive young woman, Ellen Spearman, an earnest Catholic girl 4 years his junior, the daughter of working-class parents who many years earlier had also emigrated from Ireland. Frank and Ellen fell in love and were married the 6th of November, 1883, at St. Peter's Cathedral in London. They started to raise a large family. Their firstborn, Hamilton, arrived in 1884. He was followed by Frank Patrick in 1886, Harold in 1888, and William in 1889. The family moved around a bit, eventually moving to Dayton, Ohio in 1891. They found themselves in a raw industrial city of 61,000, prospering from textile mills, a tobacco factory, and many small manufacturing firms. Now 39, Frank returned to one of his old trades, tending bar. He ran a saloon in downtown Dayton, with the whole family living one floor above it. Always striving to better himself, Frank tried different jobs before finding a vocation at which he excelled, that he liked, and with which he would stick: department store salesman. He moved the clan to a larger house, a modest row house on South Bainbridge Street, in a well-kept working-class section of Dayton. The extra space was needed. Margaret, the only daughter in the family, came along in 1895, followed by Charles in 1898. 2 years later, at home on Bainbridge Street, Ellen gave birth to Joseph John. Margaret, Charles, and Joe would make their way across the tracks of the old Dayton Railroad through open fields to St. Joseph Parish School, where they got their introduction to a formal education. Margaret took hold at this school. Joe did not, later making clear that a parochial education was not for him. One thing that did capture Joe's imagination had little to do with school or family. It was the presence in Dayton of Orville and Wilbur Wright, whose workshops were just a few miles from the Rochefort home. They had been making headlines since 1903, when on a windy December day in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, they had made the first sustained flight in a heavier-than-air machine. The Wrights became instant celebrities as Dayton found itself gripped by an aviation fever that touched young Joe. Frank, however, was getting restless and again decided on a change of scene, whether to escape Ohio's bland, sometimes dreary weather, or to find better prospects in the West. In 1912, Frank and Ellen herded the children onto a train and took them to Los Angeles. Their timing was good. They arrived just as the city was starting to boom and fill up with Easterners looking for opportunities. Still energetic and confident at 58, Frank found a job as a salesman in the rug department at Barker Brothers, a quality furniture store in downtown Los Angeles. He moved his wife and children, five sons — Hamilton had relocated to Boston — and a daughter, ranging in age from 12 to 26, into a cheerful bungalow in a fast-growing middle-class neighborhood in West Los Angeles. Hamilton rejoined the family a few months later in the small stucco home at 2096 West 27th Street. Everybody worked or went to school. Frank Patrick followed his father into sales. Harold worked as a plumber, William as a silver plater. Margaret found work as a telephone operator. A photographer, Hamilton opened his own studio in downtown Los Angeles. Charles stayed in high school, and Joe neared graduation from St. Vincent's Elementary School. Outwardly, the Rocheforts resembled a family out of a Currier and Ives print. Resolute, forceful, something of a taskmaster, Frank relished his role as patriarch. He joined his equally pleased wife in taking great pride in the family. A photograph of the group, taken about the time they moved into their new home, shows a mustachioed Frank looking a little like William Powell in Life with Father, amiable but very much in command. Ellen, determined and elegant, looks protective as she holds her youngest sons, Charles and Joe. The Rocheforts had high hopes for their children. College was out of the question, with insufficient money. But Frank and Ellen had strong ideas, especially for Joe. They wanted him to become a priest. Joe may not have been as extroverted as his gregarious father, but he had inherited Frank's willfulness and independence. He had no desire to enter the priesthood, an intention he made clear after finishing grammar school, when he asked his parents to let him enter Polytechnic High. This was a non-denominational school in downtown Los Angeles. They agreed. It was then that Joe started going his own way, leaving his parents wondering where his new path would lead. Even though he resembled his father in some respects, in others, he differed profoundly. When he tried his hand at sales one summer, selling magazine subscriptions door to door, the line Joe used became a standing joke in the family. "You wouldn't want to buy a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post, would you?" Joe was no salesman. High school provided few clues as to what direction he would take. Joe was a good student, at times even outstanding, but genius or brilliant did not apply. He did show a gift for mathematics, getting A's in algebra and trigonometry. But in applied electricity, geometry, physics, and chemistry, he averaged B's. He was terrible in one subject, earning a D in the now rarely used category of deportment. The reason for this does not appear in school records, and is difficult to imagine given his strict Catholic upbringing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?